Chapter 10. Maimonides has an account of a lute player who, required to perform upon some stated occasion, found that he had entirely forgot not only the piece, but the whole art of playing, fingering, everything, wrote Stephen. I have sometimes had a dread of the same thing happening to me. A not irrational dread, since I once experienced a deprivation of a similar nature. Coming back to Argamore when I was a boy, coming back after an 8 years' absence, I went to see Bridie Coolan, and she spoke to me in Irish. Her voice was intimately familiar, none more, my own wet nurse. So were the intonations and even the very words, yet nothing could I understand. Her words conveyed no meaning whatever. I was dumbfounded at my loss. What puts me in mind of this is my discovery that I no longer know what my friends feel, intend, or even mean. It is clear that J.A. met with a severe disappointment in Ciudadela, one that he feels more deeply than I should have supposed possible in him. And it is clear that J.D. is still in a state of great unhappiness. But beyond that, I know almost nothing. They do not speak, and I can no longer look into them. My own testiness does not help, to be sure. I must guard against a strong and increasing tendency to indulge in dogged, sullen conduct, the conduct of vexation, much promoted by want of exercise. But I confess that much as I love them, I could wish them both to the devil with their high-flown, egocentrical points of honour and their purblind spurring one another on to remarkable exploits that may very well end in unnecessary death. In their death, which is their concern, but also in mine, to say nothing of the rest of the ship's company. A slaughtered crew, a sunken ship and my collections destroyed, these do not weigh at all against their punctilios. There is a systematic flux in or sinihilipilification of all other aspects of existence that angers me. I spend half my time purging them, bleeding them, prescribing low diet and soporifics. They both eat far too much and drink far too much, especially J.D. Sometimes I'm afraid they have closed themselves to me because they have agreed upon a meeting next time we come ashore, and they know very well I should stop it. How they vex my very spirit! If they had the scrubbing of the decks, the hoisting of the sails, the cleaning of the heads, we should hear little enough of these fine vaporings. I have no patience for them. They're strangely immature for men of their age and position. Though, indeed, it is to be supposed that if they were not, they would not be here. The mature, the ponderate mind does not embark itself upon a man of war, is not to be found wandering about the face of the ocean in quest of violence. For all his sensibility, and he played his transcription of Dave Yeaney with a truly exquisite delicacy just before we reached Ciudadela, J.A. is in many ways more suited to be a pirate chief in the Caribbean 100 years ago. And for all his acumen, J.D. is in danger of becoming an enthusiast, a latter-day Loyola, if he's not knocked on the head first or run through the body. I am much exercised in my mind by that unfortunate conversation. The Sophie, to the astonishment of her people, had not headed for Barcelona after leaving Ciudadela, but west nor west. And at daybreak, rounding Cape Salou within hail of the shore, she had picked up a richly laden Spanish coaster of some 200 tons, mounting, but not firing, 6 six-pounders. Had picked her up from the landward side as neatly as though the rendezvous had been fixed weeks ahead and the Spanish captain had kept his hour to the minute. A very profitable commercial venture, said James, watching the prize disappear in the east, bound with a favourable wind for Port Mahon, while they beat up, tack upon tack, to their northern cruising ground, one of the busiest sea lanes in the world. But that, though unhappy in itself, was not the conversation Stephen had in mind. No, that came later, after dinner, when he was on the quarter-deck with James. They were talking in an easy, off-hand manner about differences in national habit. The Spaniards' late hours, the French way of all leaving the table together, men and women, and going directly into the drawing-room, the Irish habit of staying with the wine until one of the guests suggested moving, the English way of leaving this to the host, the remarkable difference in duelling habits. Rencounters are most uncommon in England, observed James. Indeed they are, said Stephen. I was astonished when first I went to London to find that a man might not go out from one year's end to the other. Yes, said James. Ideas upon matters of honour are altogether different in the two kingdoms. Before now I have given Englishmen provocation that would necessarily have called for a meeting in Ireland with no result. We should call that remarkably timid, or is shy the word. He shrugged, and he was about to continue when the cabin skylight in the surface of the quarter-deck opened, and Jack's head and massive shoulders appeared. I should never have thought so ingenuous a face could look so black and wicked, thought Stephen. Did J.D. say that on purpose, he wrote? I do not know for sure, though I suspect he did. It would be all of a piece with the remarks he's been making recently. Remarks that may be unintentional, merely tactful, but that all tend to present reasonable caution in an odious and indeed a contemptible light? I do not know. I should have known once. But all I know now is that when J.A. is in a rage with his superiors, irked by the subordination of the service, spurred on by his restless, uneasy temperament, or, as at present lacerated by his mistress' infidelity, he flies to violence as a relief, to action. J.D., urged on by entirely different furies, does the same. The difference is that whereas I believe J.A. merely longs for the shattering noise, immense activity of mind and body, and the all-embracing sense of the present moment, I am very much afraid that J.D. wants more. He closed the book and stared at its cover for a long while, far, far away, until a knock recalled him to the sofa. "Mr. Ricketts," he said, "what may I do for you?" "Sir," said the midshipman, "the captain says, will you please to come on deck and view the coast?" To the left of the smoke, southwards, that is the hill of Montjuïc with the great castle, and the projection to the right is Barceloneta, said Stephen, and rising there behind the city you can make out Tibidabo. I saw my first red-footed falcon there when I was a boy. Then, continuing the line from Tibidabo through the cathedral to the sea, there is the Mall de Santa Creu, with the great mercantile port, and to the left of it the basin where the king's ships and the gunboats lie. "Many gunboats?" asked Jack. "I dare say, but I never made it my study." Jack nodded, looked keenly round the bay to fix its details in his mind once more, and leaning down he called, "Deck!" "Lower away, handsomely now. Babington, look alive with that line." Stephen rose 6 inches from his perch at the masthead, and with his hands folded to prevent their involuntary clutching at passing ropes, yards, blocks, and with the ape-nimble Babington keeping pace, heaving him in towards the weather-backstay, he descended through the dizzy void to the deck, where they let him out of the cocoon in which they had hoisted him aloft. For no one on board had the least opinion of his abilities as a seaman. He thanked them absently and went below, where the sailmaker's mates were sewing Tom Simmons into his hammock. "We're just waiting for the shot, sir," they said. And as they spoke, Mr. Day appeared, carrying a net of the surface cannonballs. "I thought I'd pay him the attention myself," said the gunner, arranging them at the young man's feet with a practised hand. "He was shipmates with me in the Phoebe, though always unhealthy, even then," he added as a quick afterthought. "Oh, yes, Tom was never strong," said one of the sailmaker's mates, cutting the thread on his broken eye-tooth. These words, and a certain unusual delicacy of regard, were intended to comfort Stephen, who had lost his patient. In spite of all his efforts, the 4-day coma had deepened to its ultimate point. "Tell me, Mr. Day," he said when the sailmakers had gone, "just how much did he drink? I've asked his friends, but they give evasive answers. Indeed, they lie." "Well, of course they do, sir, for it's against the law." "How much did he drink?" "Oh, now, Tom was a popular young chap, so I dare say he had the whole allowance, bating maybe a sip or two just to moisten their victuals. That'd make it close on a quart." "A quart? Well, it's a great deal. But I'm surprised it should kill a man. At an admixture of 3 to 1, that amounts to 6 ounces or so, inebriating, but scarcely lethal." "Lord, Doctor," said the gunner, looking at him with affectionate pity, "that ain't the mixture, that's the rum." "A quart of rum? Of neat rum?" cried Stephen. "That's right, sir. Each man has his half pint a day at twice, so that makes a quart for each mess for dinner and for supper. And that is what the water is added to." "Oh, dear me," he said, laughing gently and patting the poor corpse on the deck between them. "If they was only to get half a pint of 3-water grog, we'd soon have a bloody mutiny on our hands, and quite right, too." "Half a pint of spirits a day for every man?" said Stephen, flushing with anger. "A great tumbler! I shall tell the captain, shall insist upon its being poured over the side." "And so we commit his body to the deep," said Jack, closing the book. Tom Simmons' messmates tilted the grating. There was the sound of sliding canvas, a gentle splash, and a long train of bubbles rising up through the clear water. "Now, Mr. Dillon," he said, with something of the formal tone of his reading still in his voice, "I think we may carry on with the weapons and the painting." The sloop was lying to, well over the horizon from Barcelona, and a little while after Tom Simmons had reached the bottom in 400 fathoms, she was far on her way to becoming a white-painted snow with black topsides, with a horse, a length of cable, bowsed rigidly vertical, to stand for the trysail mast of that vessel, while at the same time the grindstone mounted on the forecastle turned steadily, putting a keener edge, a sharper point, on cutlasses, pikes, boarding axes, marines' bayonets, midshipmen's dirks, officers' swords. The Sophie was as busy as she could well be, but there was a curious gravity with it all. It was natural that a man's messmate should be low after burying him, and even his whole watch, for Tom Simmons had been well liked, would never have had so deadly a birthday present otherwise. But this solemnity affected the whole ship's company, and there was none of those odd bursts of song on the forecastle, none of those ritual jokes called out. There was a quiet, brooding atmosphere, not at all angry or sullen, but Stephen, lying in his cot, he had been up all night with poor Simmons, tried to hit upon the definition. Oppressive? Fearful? But in spite of all the deeply shocking noise of Mr. Day and his party overhauling the shot lockers, scaling all the balls with any rust or irregularity upon them and trundling them back down an echoing plain, hundreds and hundreds of four-pound cannonballs clashing and growling and being beaten, he went to sleep before he could accomplish it. He woke to the sound of his own name. Dr. Maturin? No, certainly you may not see Dr. Maturin, said the master's voice in the gun-room. You may leave a message with me, and I will tell him at dinner-time if he wakes up by then. I was to ask him what physic would answer for a slack-going horse, quavered Ellis, now filled with doubt. And who told you to ask him that? That villain Babington, I swear. For shame to be such a flat after all these weeks at sea. This particular atmosphere had not reached the midshipman's berth then. Or, if so, it had already dissipated. What private lives the young led, he reflected. How very much apart. Their happiness, how widely independent of circumstance. He was thinking of his own childhood, the then intensity of the present. Happiness not then a matter of retrospection or of undue moment, when the howling of the boatswain's pipe for dinner caused his stomach to give a sharp, sudden, grinding ring, and he swung his legs over the side. I'm grown a naval animal, he observed. These were the fat days of the beginning of a cruise. There was still soft tack on the table, and Dillon, standing bowed under the beams to carve a noble saddle of mutton, said, You will find the most prodigious transformation when you go on deck. We are no longer a brig, but a snow. With an extra mast, explained the master, holding up three fingers. Indeed, said Stephen, eagerly passing up his plate. Pray, why is this? For speed, for expediency, for comeliness? To amuse the enemy. The meal continued with considerations on the art of war, the relative merits of Mahon cheese and Cheshire, and the surprising depth of the Mediterranean only a short way off the land. And once again Stephen noticed the curious skill, the outcome, no doubt, of many years at sea and the tradition of generations of tight-packed mariners, with which even so gross a man as the purser helped to keep the conversation going, smoothing over the dislikes and tensions, with platitudes quite often, but with flow enough to make the dinner not only easy, but even mildly enjoyable.
"Take care, Doctor," said the master, steadying him from behind on the companion ladder. "She's beginning to roll."
She was indeed. And although the Sophie's deck was only so trifling a height from what might be called her subaqueous gun-room, the motion up there was remarkably greater. Stephen staggered and gazed about him expectantly. "Where is your prodigious great transformation?" he cried. "Where is this third mast that is to amuse the enemy? Where is the merriment in practising upon a landman? Where the wit? Upon my honour, Mr. Farcical Comic, any poteen swilling chenine off the bog would be more delicate. Are you not sensible? It's very wrong." "Oh, sir!" cried Mr. Marshall, shocked by the sudden, extreme ferocity of Stephen's glare. "Upon my word, Mr. Dillon, I appeal to you."
"Dear shipmate Joy," said James, leading Stephen to the horse, that stout rope running parallel to the mainmast and some 6 inches behind it, "allow me to assure you that to a seaman's eye this is a mast, a third mast, and presently you will see something very like the old fore-and-aft mainsail set upon it as a trysail, at the same time as a crowjack on the yard above our heads. No seaman afloat would ever take us for a brig." "Well," said Stephen, "I must believe you. Mr. Marshall, I ask your pardon for speaking hastily."
"Why, sir, you'd have to speak more hasty by half to put me out," said the master,
who was aware of Stephen's liking for him and who valued it highly.
"It looks as though they had had a blow away to the south," he remarked, nodding over the side.
The long swell was setting from the far-off African coast, and although the small surface waves disguised it, the rise and fall of the horizon showed its long, even intervals. Stephen could very well imagine it breaking high against the rocks of the Catalan shore, rushing up the shingle beaches and drawing back with a monstrous, grating indraft. "I hope it does not rain," he said, for again and again at the beginning of the fall he had known this sea swelling up out of calmness to be followed by a southeastern wind in a low yellow sky, pouring down warm beating rain on the grapes just as they were ready to be picked. "Sail ho!" called the lookout. She was a medium-sized tartan, deep in the water, beating up into the fresh easterly breeze, obviously from Barcelona, and she lay 2 points on their port bow.
"How lucky this did not happen an hour ago," said James.
"Mr. Pullings, my duty to the captain, and there is a strange sail 2 points on the larboard bow." Before he'd finished speaking, Jack was on deck, his pen still in his hand, and a look of hard excitement kindling in his eye. "Be so kind," he said, handing Stephen the pen, and he ran up to the masthead like a boy. The deck was teeming with sailors clearing away the morning's work, trimming the sails as they surreptitiously changed course to cut the tartan off from the land, and running about with very heavy loads. And after Stephen had been bumped into once or twice and had, by your leave, said, roared into his ear often enough, he walked composedly into the cabin, sat on Jack's locker, and reflected upon the nature of a community, its reality, its difference from every one of the individuals composing it, communication within it, how affected. "Why, there you are," said Jack, returning. "She's only a tub of a merchantman, I fear. I'd hoped for something better." "Shall you catch her, do you suppose?" "Oh, yes, I dare say we shall, even if she goes about this minute. But I'd so hope for a dust-up, as we say. I can't tell you how it stretches your mind. Your black draughts and bloodletting are nothing to it. Rhubarb and senna. Tell me, if we're not prevented, shall we have some music this evening?"
"It would give me great pleasure," said Stephen.
Looking at Jack now, he could see what his appearance might be when the fire of his youth had gone out. Heavy, grey, authoritarian, if not savage and morose. "Yes," said Jack, and hesitated as though he were going to say much more. But he did not, and after a moment he went on deck. The Sophie was slipping rapidly through the water, having set no more sail, and showing no sort of inclination to close with the tartan, the steady, sober, mercantile course of a snow bound for Barcelona. In half an hour's time they could see that she carried 4 guns, that she was short-handed, the cook joined in the manoeuvres, and that she had a disagreeably careless, neutral air. However, when the tartan prepared to tack at the southern end of her board, the Sophie heaved out her staysails in a flash, set her topgallants, and bore up with surprising speed. So surprising to the tartan, indeed, that she missed stays and fell off again on the larboard tack. At half a mile, Mr. Day, he dearly loved to point a gun, put a shot across her forefoot, and she lay to with her yard lowered until the Sophie ranged alongside and Jack hailed her master to come aboard. He was sorry, gentlemen, but he could not. If he could, he should with joy, gentlemen, but he had burst the bottom of his launch, he said, through the medium of a quite lovely young woman,
presumably Mrs. Tartan or the equivalent. And in any case, he was only a neutral Ragusan, a neutral boat bound for Ragusa in ballast. The little dark man beat on his boat to mark the point, and hold it was. "What, Tartan?" called Jack again. "Paula," said the young woman. He stood considering. He was in an ugly mood. The two vessels rose and fell. Behind the tartan, the land appeared with every upward heave. And to add to his irritation, he saw a fishing boat in the south running before the wind with another beyond it. Sharp-eyed Barkalongas. The Sophies stood silently gazing at the woman. They licked their lips and swallowed. That tartan was not in ballast. A stupid lie. And he doubted it was Ragusan built, too, but Pola? Was that the right name? "Bring the cutter alongside," he said. "Mr. Dillon, who have we aboard that speaks Italian? John Baptist's an Italian." "And Abram Codpiece, sir. Purser's name. Mr. Marshall, take Baptist and Codpiece and satisfy yourself as to that tartan. Look at her papers. Look into her hold. Rummage her cabin if needs be." The cutter came alongside, the boatkeeper booming her off from the fresh paint with the utmost care, and the heavily armed men dropped into her by a line from the main yardarm, far more willing to break their necks or drown than spoil their fine black paint, so fresh and trim. They pulled across, boarded the tartan. Marshall, Codpiece, and John Baptist disappeared into the cabin. There was the sound of a female voice raised high in anger, then a piercing scream. The men on the forecastle began to skip and turn shining faces to one another. Marshall reappeared. "What did you do to that woman?" called Jack. "Knocked her down, sir," replied Marshall phlegmatically. "Tartan's no more a Ragusan than I am. Captain only talks the lingua franca. Says Codpiece, no right Italian at all. Mrs. has a Spanish set of papers in her pinny, holds full of bales consigned to Genoa." "The infamous brute to strike a woman," said James aloud. "To think we have to mess with such a fellow." "You wait till you're married, Mr. Dillon," said the purser with a chuckle. "Very well done, Mr. Marshall," said Jack. "Very good indeed. How many hands? What are they like?"
8, sir, counting passengers. Ugly, froward-looking buggers."
"Send them over, then. Mr. Dillon, steady men for the prize crew, if you please." As he spoke, rain began to fall, and with the first drops came a sound that made every head aboard turn, so that in a moment each man's nose was pointing nor'east. It was not thunder. It was gunfire. "Light along those prisoners," cried Jack. "Mr. Marshall, keep in company. It'll not worry you looking after the woman?"
"I do not mind it, sir," said Marshall.
5 minutes later they were under way, running diagonally across the swell through the sweeping rain with a lithe, corkscrewing motion. They had the wind on their beam now. And although they'd handed the topgallants almost at once, they left the tartan behind in less than half an hour. Stephen was gazing over the taffrail at the long wake, his mind 1,000 miles away, when he became aware of a hand gently plucking at his coat. He turned and saw Mowat smiling at him, and some way beyond Mowat, Ellis on his hands and knees being carefully, desperately sick through a small square hole in the bulwark, a scuttle. "Sir, sir," said Mowat, "you're getting wet."
"Yes," said Stephen, and after a pause he added, "it's the rain."
"That's right, sir," said Mowat. "Should not you like to step below to get out of it, or may I bring you a tarpaulin jacket?" "No, no, no, you're very good. No, said Stephen, his attention wandering. And Merritt, having failed in the first part of his mission, went cheerfully on to the second. This was to stop Stephen's whistling, which made the afterguard and quarter-deck men, the crew in general, so very nervous and uneasy. "May I tell you something nautical, sir? Do you hear the guns again?"
"If you please," said Stephen, unpursing his lips.
"Well then, sir," said Merritt, pointing over the grey hissing sea to his right in the general direction of Barcelona, "that is what we call a lee shore."
"Ah," said Stephen, with a certain interest lighting his eye,
"the phenomenon you dislike so much?
It's not a mere prejudice, a weak, superstitious, traditional belief?"
"Oh, no, sir," cried Merritt, and explained the nature of leeway, the loss of windward distance in wearing, the impossibility of tacking in a very great wind, the inevitability of leeward drift in the case of being embayed with a full gale blowing dead on short, and the impervious horror of this situation. His explanation was punctuated by the deep boom of gunfire, sometimes a continuous low roaring for half a minute together, sometimes a single sharp report. "Oh, how I wonder what it is," he cried, breaking off and craning up on tiptoe.
"You need not be afraid," said Stephen. "Soon the wind will blow in the direction of the waves. This often happens towards Michaelmas."
"If only one could protect the vines with a vast umbrella."
Mowat was not alone in wondering what it was. The Sophie's captain and lieutenant, each burning for the uproar and the more than human liberation of a battle, stood side by side on the quarter-deck, infinitely remote from one another, all their senses straining towards the northeast. Almost all the other members of the crew were equally intent, and so were those of the Felipe Cinco, a 7-gun Spanish privateer. She came racing up out of the blinding rain, a dark squall a little way abaft the beam on the landward side, making for the sound of battle with all the canvas she could bear. They saw one another at the same moment. The Felipe fired, showed her colours, received the Sophie's broadside in reply, grasped her mistake, put up her helm and headed straight back to Barcelona, with the strong wind on her larboard quarter and her big lateens bellying out and swaying wildly on the roll. The Sophie's helm was over within a second of the privateers. The tompions of the starboard guns were out. Cupping hands sheltered the sputtering slow match and the priming. "All at her stern," cried Jack, and the crows and handspikes heaved the guns through 5 degrees. "On the roll, fire as they bear." He brought the wheel up 2 spokes, and the guns went off 3 and 4. Instantly, the privateer yawed as though she meant to board. But then her flapping mizzen came down on deck. She filled again and went off before the wind. A shot had struck the head of her rudder, and without it she could bear no sail aft. They were putting out a sweep to steer with, and working furiously at the mizzen yard. Her 2 larboard guns fired, one hitting the Sophie with the strangest sound, but the sloop's next broadside, a careful, collected fire within pistol range, together with a volley of musketry, put a stop to all resistance. Just 12 minutes after the first gun fired, her colours came down, and a fierce, delighted cheer broke out, men clapping one another on the back, shaking hands, laughing. The rain had stopped, and it was drifting westwards in a dense, grey swathe, blotting out the port, very much nearer now. "Take possession of her, Mr. Dillon, if you please," said Jack, looking up at the dog vane. The wind was veering, as it so often did in these waters after rain, and presently it would be coming from well south of east. "Any damage, Mr. Lamb?" he asked as the carpenter came up to report.
"Wish you joy of the capture, sir," said the carpenter. "No damage, rightly speaking, no structural damage, But that one ball made a sad mess in the galley. Upset all the coppers and unshipped the smoke funnel.
We'll take a look at it presently, said Jack. Mr. Pullings, those forward guns are not properly secured.
What the devil? He cried. The gun crews were strangely, even shockingly, pied. And horrible imaginations flashed through his mind, until he realised that they were covered with wet black paint and with the galley's soot. And now, in the exuberance of their hearts, those farthest forward were daubing their fellows.
"Avast that goddamn fucking foolery! God rot your fucking eyes!" he called out, in an enormous line-of-battle voice.
He rarely swore, apart from an habitual damn, or an unmeaning blasphemy, and the men, who in any case had expected him to be far more pleased with the taking of a neat privateer, fell perfectly mute, with nothing more than the rolling of an eye or a wink to convey secret understanding and delight.
"Deck!" called Lukoc from the top. "There are gunboats coming out from Barcelona. 6, 8, 9, 11 behind them, maybe more."
"Out launch and jolly boat," cried Jack. "Mr. Lamb, go across, if you please, and see what can be done to her steering."
Getting the boats to the yardarms and launching them in this swell was no child's play, but the men were in tearing spirits, and they heaved like maniacs. It was as though they'd been filled with rum and yet had lost none of their ability. Muffled laughter kept bursting out. It was damped by the cry of a sail to windward, a sail that might place them between two fires, then revived by the news that it was only their own prize, the Tartan. The boats plied to and fro. The glum or surly prisoners made their way down into the forehold, their bosoms swollen with personal possessions. The carpenter and his crew could be heard working away with their adzes to make a new tiller. Stephen caught Ellis as he darted by.
"Just when did you stop being sick, sir?"
"Almost the moment the guns began to go, sir," said Ellis.
Stephen nodded. "I thought as much," said he. "I was watching you."
The first shot sent up a white plume of water, topmast high, right between the two vehicles. Infernally good practice for a ranging shot, thought Jack, and a damn great heavy ball. The gunboats were still over a mile away, but they were coming up surprisingly fast, straight into the eye of the wind. Each of the three foremost carried a long 36-pounder and rowed 30 oars. Even at a mile, a chance hit from one of these would pierce the Sophie through and through. He had to restrain a violent urge to tell the carpenter to hurry.
"If a 36-pound ball doesn't hasten him, nothing I can say will do so," he observed, pacing up and down, cocking an eye at the dog vane and at the gunboats at each turn. All seven of the foremost had tried the range, and now there was a spasmodic firing, most falling short, but some howling right overhead. "Mr. Dillon," he called over the water, after half a dozen turns and the splash from a ball plunging into the swell just astern wetted the back of his neck. "Mr. Dillon, we will transfer the rest of the prisoners later and make sail as soon as you can conveniently do so. Or should you like us to pass you a tow?"
"No, thank you, sir. The tiller will be shipped in 2 minutes."
"In the meantime, we might as well pepper them for what it's worth," reflected Jack, for the now silent Sophies were looking somewhat tense. "At least the smoke will hide us a little. Mr. Pullings, the larboard guns may fire at discretion."
This was much more agreeable, with the banging, the rumble, the smoke, the immense, intent activity. And he smiled to see the earnestness of every man at the brass gun nearest him, as they glared out for the fall of their shot. The Sophie's fire stung the gunboats to a great burst of activity, and the dull grey western sea sparkled with their flashes over a front of a quarter of a mile. Babington was in front of him, pointing. Wheeling about, Jack saw Dillon hailing through the din. The new tiller had been fitted. "Make sail," he said. The Sophie's backed foretopsail came round and filled.
Speed was called for, and setting all our headsails, he took her down with the wind well abaft her beam before hauling up into the Norma West. This took the sloop nearer to the gunboats and across their front. The larboard guns were firing continuously, the enemy's shots were kicking up the water or passing overhead, and for a moment his spirits rose to a wild pitch of delight at the idea of dashing down among them. They were unwieldy brutes at close quarters. But then he reflected that he had the prizes with him, and that Dillon still had a dangerous number of prisoners aboard, and he gave the order to brace the yards up sharp. The prizes hauled their wind at the same time, and at a smooth 5 or 6 knots they ran out to sea. The gunboats followed for half an hour, but as the light faded and the range lengthened to impossibility, one by one they turned and went back to Barcelona. "I played that very badly," said Jack, putting down his bow.
"Your heart wasn't in it," said Stephen. "It's been an active day, a fatiguing day."
"A satisfactory day, however."
"Why, yes," said Jack, his face brightening somewhat. "Yes, certainly. I am most uncommonly delighted."
A pause.
"Do you remember a fellow named Pitt we dined with one day at Mahon?"
"The soldier?"
"Yes." "Now, would you call him good-looking, handsome?"
"No.
Oh, no."
"I'm happy to hear you say so. I have a great regard for your opinion.
Tell me," he added after a long pause, "have you noticed how things return to your mind when you're hipped?
It's like old wounds breaking out when you come down with scurvy. Not, indeed, that I have ever for a moment forgotten what Dillon said to me that day, but it has been rankling in my heart, and I've been turning it over this last day or so. I find that I must ask him for an explanation. I should certainly have done so before. I shall do so as soon as we go into port. Unless, indeed, the next few days make it unnecessary."
"Pum, pum, pum, pum," went Stephen in unison with his cello, glancing at Jack. There was an exceedingly serious look on that dark and heavy face, a kind of red light in his clouded eyes. "I am coming to believe that laws are the prime cause of unhappiness. It is not merely a case of born under one law required another to obey. You know the lines. I have no memory for verse. No, sir. It is born under half a dozen required another 50 to obey. There are parallel sets of laws in different keys that have nothing to do with one another and that are even downright contradictory. You, now, you wish to do something that the Articles of War and, as you explained to me, the Rules of Generosity forbid. But that your present notion of the moral law and your present notion of the point of honour require. This is but one instance of what is as common as breathing. Buridan's ass died of misery between equidistant mangers, drawn first by one, then by the other. Then again, with a slight difference, there are these double loyalties, another great source of torment. Upon my word, I cannot see what you mean by double loyalty. You can only have one king, and a man's heart can only be in one place at a time, unless he's a scrub.
What nonsense you do talk, to be sure, said Stephen. What balls, as you see officers say.
It is a matter of common observation that a man may be sincerely attached to 2 women at once, to 3, to 4, to a very surprising number of women. However, he said, no doubt you know more of these things than I. No, what I had in mind were these wider loyalties, these more general conflicts. The candid American, for example, before the issue became envenomed. The unimpassioned Jacobite in 45. Catholic priests in France today. Frenchmen of many complexions in and out of France. So much pain. And the more honest the man, the worse the pain. But there at least the conflict is direct. It seems to me that the greater mass of confusion and distress must arise from these less evident divergences. The moral law, the civil, military, common laws, the code of honour, custom, the rules of practical life, of civility, of amorous conversation, gallantry, to say nothing of Christianity for those that practice it, all sometimes, indeed, generally at variance, none ever in an entirely harmonious relation to the rest. And a man is perpetually required to choose one rather than another. Perhaps, in his particular case, it's contrary. It is as though our strings were each tuned according to a completely separate system. It is as though the poor ass were surrounded by 24 mangers. You're an antinomian, said Jack.
I am a pragmatist, said Stephen.
Come, let us drink up our wine, and I will compound you a dose.
Requies Nicolai.
Perhaps tomorrow you should be let blood. It is 3 weeks since you was let blood. Well, I will swallow your dose, said Jack, but I tell you what, tomorrow night I shall be in among those gunboats and I shall do the bloodletting. And don't they wish they may relish it? The Sophie's allowance of fresh water for washing was very small, and she made no allowance of soap at all. Those men who had blackened themselves and one another with paint remained darker than was pleasant, and those who had worked in the wrecked galley, covering themselves with grease and soot from the coppers and the stove, looked, if anything, worse. They had a curiously bestial and savage appearance, worst of all in those that had fair hair. The only respectable-looking fellows are the black men, said Jack. They are all still aboard, I believe.
Davies went with Mr. Mowat and the privateer, sir, said James, but the rest are still with us.
Counting the men left in Mahon and the prize crews, how many are we short at the moment?
36, sir. We are 54 all told.
Very good. That gives us elbow room. Let them have as much sleep as possible, Mr. Dillon. We shall stand in at midnight. Summer had come back after the rain. A gentle, steady tramontana, warm, clear air, and phosphorescence on the sea. The lights of Barcelona twinkled with uncommon brilliance, and over the middle part of the city floated a luminous cloud. The gunboats guarding the approaches to the port could be made out quite clearly against this background before ever they saw the darkened Sophie. They were farther out than usual, and they were obviously on the alert. As soon as they start to come for us, reflected Jack, we will set to gallants, steer for the orange light, then haul our wind at the last moment, and run between the two on the northern end of the line. His heart was going with a steady, even beat, a little faster than usual. Stephen had drawn off 10 ounces of blood, and he thought he felt much the better for it. At all events, his mind was as clear and sharp as he could wish. The moon's tip appeared above the sea. A gunboat fired, deep, booming note, the voice of an old solitary hound. "The light, Mr. Ellis," said Jack. And a blue flare soared up, designed to confuse the enemy. It was answered with Spanish signals, hoists of coloured lights, and then another gun far over to the right. "T'gallants," he said. "Jeffreys, steer for that orange mark." This was splendid. The Sophie was running in fast, prepared, confident and happy. But the gunboats were not coming on as he'd hoped.
Now one would spin about and fire, and now another. But on the whole, they were falling back. To stir them up, the sloop yawed and sent her broadside skipping among them. With some effect, to judge by a distant howl. Yet still the gunboats moved away. "Damn this," said Jack. "They're trying to lead us on. Mr. Dillon, trysail and staysails. We'll make a dash for that fellow farthest out." The Sophie came round fast and brought the wind onto her beam. Heeling over so that the silk-black water lapped at her port sills, she raced towards the nearest gunboat. But now the others showed what they could do if they chose. They all faced about in a moment and kept up a continuous raking fire while the chosen gunboat fled, quartering away, keeping the Sophie's unprotected stern towards them. A glancing blow from a 36-pounder made her whole hull ring again. Another passed just above head height the whole length of the deck. Two neatly severed backstays fell across Babington, Pullings, and the man at the wheel, knocking them down. A heavy block clattered onto the wheel itself as James leapt for its spokes. "We'll tack, Mr. Dillon," said Jack, and a few moments later the Sophie flew up into the wind. The men working the sloop moved with the unthinking smoothness of long practice, but seen suddenly picked out by the flashes of the gunboat's fire, they seemed to be jerking like so many puppets. Just after the order "let go and haul," there were six shots in quick succession, and he saw the marines at the mainsheet in a rapid series of galvanic motions, a few inches between each illumination. But throughout they wore exactly the same concentrated, diligent expressions of men tallying with all their might. "Close haul, sir?" asked James. 1.3, said Jack, "but gently, gently. Let's see if we can draw them out. Drop the main topsail yard a couple of feet and slacken away the starboard lift. Let's look as though we were winged. Mr. Watt, the topgallant backstays are our first care." And so they all moved back again across the same miles of sea, the Sophie knotting and splicing, the gunboats following and firing steadily, the old left-handed moon climbing with her usual indifference. There wasn't much conviction in the pursuit, but even so, a little while after James Dillon had reported the completion of the essential repairs, Jack said, "If we go about and set all sail like lightning, I believe we can cut those heavy chaps off from the land." "All hands about ship," said James. The boatswain started his call, and racing to his post by the main topsail bowline, Isaac said to John Lakey, "We're going to cut those two heavy buggers off from the land," with intense satisfaction. So they might have, if an unlucky shot had not struck the Sophie's fore-to-gallant yard. They saved the sail, but her speed dropped at once, and the gunboats pulled away ahead, away and away, until they were safe behind their mole. "Now, Mr. Ellis," said James, as the light of dawn showed just how much the sloop's rigging had suffered in the night, "here is a most capital opportunity for learning your profession. Why, I dare say there's enough to keep you busy until sunset, or even longer, with every variety of splice, knot, service, and parcelling you could desire." He was singularly gay, and from time to time, as he hurried about the deck, he hummed or chanted a sort of song. There was the swaying up of the new yard, too, some shot holes to be repaired, and the bowsprit to be new-gammoned, for the strangest grazing ricochet had cut half the turns without ever touching the wood. Something the oldest seamen aboard had never yet beheld, a wonder to be recorded in the log. The Sophie lay there, unmolested, putting herself to rights all through that sunny, gentle day, as busy as a hive, watchful, prepared, bristling with pugnacity. It was a curious atmosphere aboard her. The men knew very well they were going in again very soon, perhaps for some raid on the coast, perhaps for some cutting-out expedition. Their mood was affected by many things. By their captures of yesterday and last Tuesday, the consensus was that each man was worth 14 guineas more than when he sailed. By their captain's continuing gravity. By the strong conviction aboard that he had private intelligence of Spanish sailings. And by the sudden strange merriment or even levity of their lieutenant. He had found Michael and Joseph Kelly, Matthew Johnson and John Melsom, busily pilfering aboard the Felipe Cinco between decks. A very serious court-martial offence, although custom winked at the taking of anything above hatches, and one that he particularly abhorred as being a damned privateer's trick. Yet he'd not reported them. They kept peering at him from behind masts, spars, boats, and so did their guilty messmates, for the Sophies were much given to rapine. The outcome of all these factors was an odd, busy, restrained, quietly cheerful attentiveness with a note of anxiety in it. With all hands so busy, Stephen scrupled to go forward to his elm-tree pump, through whose unshipped head he daily observed the wonders of the deep, and where his presence was now so usual that he might have been the pump itself for all the restraint he placed upon the men's conversation. But he caught this note, and he shared the uneasiness that produced it. James was in tearing spirits at dinner. He had invited Pullings and Babington informally, and their presence, together with Marshall's absence, gave the meal something of the air of a festivity, in spite of the purser's brooding silence. Stephen watched him as he joined in the chorus of Babington's song, thundering out, "And this is law I will maintain until my dying day, sir, that whatsoever king shall reign, I will be the vicar of Bray, sir," in a steady roar. "Well done," he cried, thumping the table. "Now, a glass of wine all round to whet our whistles, and then we must be on deck again. Though it's a cursed thing for a host to say. What a relief it is to be fighting with king's ships again, rather than these damned privateers," he observed, apropos of nothing, when the young men and the purser had withdrawn. "What a romantic creature you are, to be sure," said Stephen. "A ball fired from a privateer's cannon makes the same hole as a king's." "Me, romantic?" cried James with real indignation, an angry light coming into his green eyes. "Yes, my dear," said Stephen, taking snuff. "You'll be telling me next about their divine right." "Well, at least even you, with your wild, enthusiastic, levelling notions, will not deny that the king is the sole fount of honour." "Not I," said Stephen, "not for a moment." "When I was last at home," said James, filling Stephen's glass, "we waked old Terence Healy. He had been my grandfather's tenant, and there was a song they sang there has been in the middle part of my mind all day. I cannot quite bring it to the front to sing it." "Was it an Irish song or an English?" "There were English words as well. One line went, 'All the wild geese a-flying, 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 the wild geese a-swimming upon the grey sea.'" Stephen whistled a bar, and then, in his disagreeable craic, he sang, "They will never return, for the white horse has scunnered. Has scunnered, has scunnered, the white horse has scunnered upon the green lea."
"That's it! That's it! Bless you!" cried James, and walked off, humming the air, to see that the Sophie was gathering the utmost of her strength. She made her way out to sea at sunset with a great show of farewell forever, and set her course soberly for Minorca.
and some time before dawn she ran ashore again, still with the same good breeze a little east of north. But now there was a true autumnal nip in it, and a dampness that brought fungi in beechwoods to Stephen's mind. And over the water lay impalpable, wafting hazes. Some of them a most uncommon brown. The Sophie was standing in with her starboard tacks aboard, steering west-nor-west. Hammocks had been piped up and stowed in the nettings. The smell of coffee and frying bacon mingled together in the eddies that swirled on the weather side of her taut trysail. Wide on the port bow, the brown mist still hid the Llobregat Valley and the mouth of the river. But farther up the coast towards the dim city looming there on the horizon, the rising sun had burnt off all but a few patches of haze. Those that remained might have been headlands, islands, sandbanks. I know, those gunboats were trying to lead us into some trap, said Jack, and am with child to know what it was. Jack was no great hand at dissembling, and Stephen was instantly persuaded that he knew the nature of the trap perfectly well, or at least had a very good notion of what it was likely to be. The sun worked upon the surface of the water, doing wonderful things to its colour, raising new mists, dissolving others, sending exquisite patterns of shadow among the taut lines of the rigging and the pure curves of the sails, and down onto the white deck, now being scrubbed whiter to the steady, grinding noise of holy stones. With a swift yet imperceptible movement, it breathed away a blue-grey cape, and revealed a large ship, 3 points on the starboard bow, running southwards under the land. The lookout called that she was there, but in a matter-of-fact voice, formally, for as the cloud bank dissolved, she was hull up from the deck. "Very well," said Jack, clasping his glass too after a long stare. "What do you make of her, Mr. Dillon?"
"I rather think she is our old friend, sir," said James.
"So do I. Set the main staysail and haul up to close her. Swabs aft, dry the deck. And let the hands go to breakfast at once, Mr. Dillon. Should you care to take a cup of coffee with the doctor and me, it would be a sad shame to waste it."
"Very happy, sir."
There was almost no conversation during their breakfast. Jack said, "I suppose you'd like us to put on silk stockings, Doctor." "Why silk stockings, for all love?" "Oh, everyone says it's easier for the surgeon if he has to cut one up." "Yes, yes, certainly. Pray do, by all means, put on silk stockings." No conversation, but there was a remarkable feeling of easy companionship. And Jack, standing up to put on his uniform coat, said to James, "You're certainly right, you know." As though they'd been talking about the identity of the stranger throughout the meal. On deck again, he saw that it was so, of course. The vessel over there was the Cacafuego. She had altered course to meet the Sophie, and she was in the act of setting her studding sails. In his telescope, he could see the vermilion gleam of her side in the sun. "All hands aft," he said. And as they waited for the crew to assemble, Stephen could see that a smile kept spreading on his face, that he had to make a conscious effort to repress it and look grave. "Men," he said, looking over them with pleasure, "that's the Cacafuego to windward, you know. Now, some of you were not quite pleased when we let her go without a compliment last time, but now, with our gunnery the best in the fleet, why, it's another thing. So, Mr. Dillon, we will clear for action, if you please." When he began to speak, perhaps half the Sophies were gazing at him with uncomplicated, pleasurable excitement. Perhaps a quarter looked a little troubled, and the rest had downcast and anxious faces. but the self-possessed happiness radiating for their captain and his lieutenant, and the spontaneous, delighted cheer from the first half of the crew changed this wonderfully. And as they set about clearing the sloop, there were not above four or five who looked glum. The others might have been going to the fair. The Cacafuego, square-rigged at present, was running down, turning in a steady westward sweep to get to windward and seaward of the Sophie. And the Sophie was pointing up close into the wind, so that by the time they were a long half-mile apart, she was directly open to a raking broadside from the frigate. The 32-gun frigate. "The pleasant thing about fighting with the Spaniards, Mr. Ellis," said Jack, smiling at his great round eyes and solemn face, "is not that they are shy, for they are not, but that they are never, never ready." The Cacafuego had now almost reached the station that her captain had set his mind upon. She fired a gun and broke out the Spanish colours. "The American flag, Mr. Babington," said Jack. "That'll give them something to think about. Note down the time, Mr. Richards." The distance was lessening very fast now, second after second, not minute after minute. The Sophie was pointing astern of the Cacafuego, as though she meant to cut her wake, and not a gun could the sloop bring to bear. There was a total silence aboard, as every man stood ready for the order to tack, an order that might not come before the broadside. "Stand by with the ensign," said Jack in a low voice and louder. "Right, Mr. Dillon. Helms a lee!" And the boatswain's call sounded almost at the same moment. The Sophie spun on her heel, ran up the English colours, steadied and filled on her new course, and ran, close-hauled, straight for the Spaniard's side. The Cacafuego fired at once, a crashing broadside that shot over and among the Sophie's topgallants, making four holes no more. The Sophie's cheered to a man, and stood tense and eager by their treble-shotted guns. "Full elevation!" "Not a shot till we touch," cried Jack in a tremendous voice, watching the hen-coops, boxes and lumber tossing overboard from the frigate. Through the smoke he could see ducks swimming away from one coop and a panic-stricken cat on a box. The smell of powder smoke reached them, and the dispersing mist. Closer, closer. They would be becalmed under the Spaniard's lee at the last moment, but they would have way enough. He could see the round blackness of her guns' mouths now, and as he watched, so they erupted, the flashes brilliant in the smoke, and a great white bank of it hiding the frigate's side. Too high again, he observed, but there was no room for any particular emotion as he searched through the faults in the smoke to put the sloop right up against the frigate's main chains. "Hard over!" he shouted, and as the grinding crash came, "Fire!" The Zeebeck frigate was low in the water, but the Sophie was lower still. With her yards locked in the Cacafuego's rigging, she lay there, and her guns were below the level of the frigate's ports. She fired straight up through the Cacafuego's deck, and her first broadside at a 6-inch range did shocking devastation. There was a momentary silence after the Sophie's cheer, and in that half-second's pause, Jack could hear a confused screaming on the Spaniard's quarter-deck. Then the Spanish guns spoke again, irregular now but immensely loud, firing 3 feet above his head. The Sophie's broadside was firing in a splendid roll. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, with a half-beat at the end and a rumbling of the trucks. And in the fourth or fifth pause, James seized his arm and shouted, "They gave the order to board!" "Mr. Watt, boom her off!" cried Jack, directing his speaking trumpet forward. "Sergeant, stand by!" One of the Cacafuego's backstays had fallen aboard, fouling the carriage of a gun. He passed it round a stanchion, and as he looked up, a swarm of Spaniards appeared on the Cacafuego's side. The marines and small-arms men gave them a staggering volley, and they hesitated.
The gap was widening as the boatswain at the head and Dillon's party aft thrust on their spars. Amidst a crackling of pistols, some Spaniards tried to jump, some tried to throw grapnels. Some fell in and some fell back. The Sophie's guns, now 10 feet from the frigate's side, struck right into the midst of the waverers, tore 7 most dreadful holes. The Cacafuego's head had fallen off. She was pointing nearly south, and the Sophie had all the wind she needed to range alongside again. Again the thundering din roared and echoed round the sky, with the Spaniards trying to depress their guns, trying to fire down with muskets and blindly held chance pistols over the side to kill the gun crews. Their efforts were brave enough. One man balanced there to fire until he'd been hit 3 times, but they seemed totally disorganized. Twice again they tried to board, and each time the sloop sheered off, cutting them up with terrible slaughter, lying off 5 or 10 minutes, battering her upper works, before coming in again to tear out her bowels. By now the guns were so hot that they could scarcely be touched. They were kicking furiously with every round. The sponges hissed and charred as they went in, and the guns were growing almost as dangerous to their crews as to their enemies. And all this time the Spaniards fired on and on, irregularly, spasmodically, but never stopping. The Sophie's maintop had been hit again and again, and now it was coming to pieces. Great lumps of timber falling down on deck, stanchions, hammocks. Her foresail yard was held only by its chains. Rigging hung in every direction, and the sails had innumerable holes. Burning wad was flying aboard all the time, and the unengaged starboard crews were running to and fro with their fire buckets. Yet within its confusion, the Sophie's deck showed a beautiful pattern of movement, the powder passing up from the magazine and the shot, the gun crews with their steady heave, crash, heave, a wounded man, a dead man, carrying below, his place instantly taken without a word, every man intent, threading the dense smoke. No collisions, no jostling, almost no orders at all. "We shall be a mere hull presently, however," reflected Jack. It was unbelievable that no mast or yard had gone yet. But it couldn't last. Leaning down to Ellis, he said in his ear, "Cut along to the galley. Tell the cook to put all his dirty pans and coppers upside down. Pullings, Babington, stop the firing. Boom off, boom off. Back topsails, Mr. Dillon. Let the starboard watch black their faces in the galley as soon as I've spoken to them. Men! Men!" he shouted as the Cacafuego slowly forged ahead. "We must board and carry her. Now's the time. Now or never. Now or no quarter. Now while she's staggering. 5 minutes hearty and she's ours. Axes and broadswords and away. Starbolins, black their faces in the galley and forward with Mr. Dillon. The rest, aft along o' me." He darted below. Stephen had 4 quiet wounded men, 2 corpses. "We're boarding her," said Jack. "I must have your man. Every man, Jack, aboard. Will you come?"
"I will not," said Stephen. "I will steer if you choose."
"Do, yes, do. Come on," cried Jack. On the littered deck and in the smoke, Stephen saw the towering Zeebex poop some 20 yards ahead on the port bow. The Sophie's crew in 2 parties, the one black-faced and armed racing from the galley and gathering at the head, the other already aft lining the rail. The purser, pale and glaring, wild. The gunner blinking from the darkness below. The cook with his cleaver. Jack in the dust. The ship's barber and his own loblolly boy were there. Stephen noticed his hare lip grinning, and he cherishing the curved spike of a boarding axe, saying over and over again, "I'll hit the buggath, I'll hit the buggath, I'll hit the buggath." Some of the Spanish guns were still firing out into the vacancy. "Braces!" called Jack, and the yards began to come round to fill the topsails. "Dear doctor, you know what to do?" Stephen nodded, taking over the spokes and feeling the life of the wheel. The quartermaster stepped away, picked up a cutlass with a grim look of delight. "Doctor,
What's the Spanish for 50 more men?
Otros 50.
Otros 50, said Jack, looking into his face with a most affectionate smile. Now, lay us alongside, I beg. He nodded to him again, walked to the bulwark with his coxswain close behind him, and hoisted himself up, massive but lithe, and stood there, holding the foremost shroud and swinging his sword, a long, heavy cavalry sabre. Holes and all, the topsails filled, the Sophie ranged up. Stephen put the wheel hard over. The grinding crunch, the twang of some rope parting, a jerk, and they were fast together. With an enormous, shrieking cheer, fore and aft, the Sophies leapt up the frigate's side. Jack was over the shattered bulwark, straight down onto a hot gun running and smoking, and its swabber thrust at him with the pole. He cut sideways at the swabber's head. The swabber ducked fast, and Jack leapt over his bowed shoulder onto the Cacafuego's deck. "Come on! Come on!" he roared, and rushed forwards, striking furiously at the fleeing gun crew, and then at the pikes and swords opposing him. There were hundreds, hundreds of men crowding the deck, he noticed. And all the time he kept roaring, "Come on!" For some moments the Spaniards gave way as though amazed, and every one of the Sophie's men and boys came aboard, amidships and over the bow. The Spaniards gave way from abaft the mainmast, backing into the waist. But there they rallied, and now there was hard fighting. Now there were cruel blows given and received, a dense mass of struggling men tripping among the spars, scarcely room to fall, beating, hacking, pistoling one another, and detached fights of two or three men together round the edges, yelling like beasts. In the looser part of the main battle, Jack had forced his way some 3 yards in. He had a soldier in front of him, and as their swords clashed high, so a pikeman drove under his right arm, ripping the flesh outside his ribs and pulling out to stab again. Immediately behind him, Bondon fired his pistol, blowing off the lower part of Jack's ear and killing the pikeman where he stood. Jack fainted at the soldier, a quick double slash, and brought his sword down on his shoulder with terrible force. The fight surged back. The soldier fell. Jack heaved out his sword, tight in bone, and glanced quickly fore and aft. "This won't do," he said. Forward, under the forecastle, the sheer weight and number of the 300 Spaniards, now half recovered from their surprise, was pushing the Sophie's back, driving a solid wedge between his band and Dillon's in the bows. Dillon must have been held up. The tide might turn at any second now. He leapt onto a gun, and with a hail that ripped his throat, he roared, "Dillon! Dillon! The starboard gangway! Thrust for the starboard gangway!" For a fleeting moment, at the edge of his field of vision, he was aware of Stephen, far below on the deck of the Sophie, holding her wheel and gazing collectedly upwards. "Otra cincuenta!" he shouted for good measure, and as Stephen nodded, calling out something in Spanish, he raced back into the fight, his sword high and his pistol searching. At this moment there was a frightful shrieking on the forecastle, a most bitter, furious drive for the head of the gangway, a desperate struggle. Something gave, and the dense mass of Spaniards in the waist turned to see these black faces rushing at them from behind. A confused milling round the frigate's bell, cries of every kind, the blackened Sophies cheering like madmen as they joined their friends, shots, the clash of arms, a trampling, huddled retreat, all the Spaniards in the waist, hampered, crowded in upon, unable to strike. The few on the quarterdeck ran forward along the larboard side to try to rally the people, to bring them into some order, at least to disengage the useless marines. Jack's opponent,
a little seaman, writhed away behind the capstan, and Jack heaved back out of the press. He looked up and down the clear run of deck.
"Bondon!" he shouted, plucking his arm. "Go and strike those colours!"
Bondon ran aft, leaping over the dead Spanish captain. Jack hallooed and pointed. Hundreds of eyes, glancing, or staring, or suddenly looking back, half-comprehending, saw the Cacafuego's ensign race down. Her colours struck. It was over.
"Last fighting!"
cried Jack, and the order ran round the deck. The Sophies backed away from the packed mob in the waist, and the men there threw down their weapons. Suddenly dispirited, frightened, cold, and betrayed. The senior surviving Spanish officer struggled out of the crowd in which he had been penned and offered Jack his sword.
"Do you speak English, sir?"
asked Jack.
"I understand it, sir,"
said the officer. "The men must go down into the hold, sir, at once," said Jack. "The officers on deck. The men down into the hold. Down into the hold." The Spaniard gave the order. The frigate's crew began to file down the hatchways. As they went, so the dead and wounded were discovered. A tangled mass amidships, many more foreheads, single bodies everywhere. And so, too, the true number of the attackers grew clear. "Quickly, quickly!" cried Jack, and his men urged the prisoners below, herding them fast, for they understood the danger as well as their captain. "Mr. Day, Mr. Watt, get a couple of their guns, those carronades, pointing down the hatchways, load with canister. There's plenty in the garlands aft. Where's Mr. Dillon? Pass the word for Mr. Dillon." The word passed, and no answer came. He was lying there near the starboard gangway where the most desperate fighting had been, a couple of steps from little Ellis. When Jack picked him up, he thought he was only hurt. But turning him, he saw the great wound in his heart.